not have known it was there. It's this blank page between the Old Testament and the New. So you can make your notes in there, you know, as to what happened. But there was an awful lot that did happen in that during that blank period. For example, very quickly, as the Old Testament ends, in the period of the 6th century. So the 6th century B.C. would be 500 to 599. We saw a rebuilt temple after people came back from Babylonian captivity. We see the worship restored in the temple. We see the walls around Jerusalem. That carried on into the 4th century B.C. The 5th century. We see a remnant of people that have come back to the promised land. We see the battles that were done between them and the Samaritan people. If you remember that Sanballat character, opposed the Jews at every turn in their return to Jerusalem. We also see the world ruled by the Persians. They were the world power. We'll show you a chart here in a moment to show the extent of their reign. Now, as the New Testament begins, so we call it the late 1st century B.C., we see a world ruled by Rome. So we need, I think, some background as to how that occurred. We see a political power in Jerusalem and in the priesthood. The priests had great political power. Now, to put Jesus to death, they had to go to those Roman governors there, Pilate and others, other governors there, or Pilate in particular, to get permission to carry out capital punishment. And there's a reason for that. That was a rule within the Roman Empire. We also see a king, and he is called a king, Herod, over Palestine. So where did he come from? You know, David was the last king in the United Kingdom, and then there was a succession of kings in Judah, the southern kingdom of Judah. But then the kingship ceased after Jerusalem was taken over by Babylon. And all of a sudden we open up Matthew and there's King Herod there. So where did he come from? We'll find out. A great man. You'd really want him as a neighbor. He killed at least three of his sons and at least one of his wives and others who he thought were a threat to his reign. Really, really good man to have around. We also see many new and strange entities. We see the tax collectors. That was one of the prime functions of the Roman representatives. In fact, I learned this. I did not know. There's a lot that I didn't know until I started preparing for this class. But the term procurator, we typically think, well, that's just another name for governor. But what does it mean to procure? It means to get, right? The main function of the procurator was to procure taxes for the Roman government. And all of this money had, you know, was bottled up and shipped out to Rome, and Rome, you know, at its height was fabulously wealthy because of everywhere it conquered people, the taxes had to be sent back to Rome. We see the political power, we saw that, many new strange entities, synagogues. We see synagogues just spoken of routinely. We don't see that word, although there may be hints of it, but certainly we don't see words of that like that in the Old Testament. Herodians. Well, that looks a lot like Herod, so that looks like people that were supportive of the Herod dynasty, and that's exactly correct. We see Sadducees and Pharisees. Now, Bible students are more familiar with them, but oftentimes we don't ask, well, those words, those terms were not in the Old Testament, so where did these people come from? And we'll find that it's I would say, probable, if not more certain, that they occurred or sprung up in that 500 years or so prior to Christ. We see the Sanhedrin, or Sanhedrin, depending on your pronunciation. Or you see a group of people who held great power. We see Jesus before the Sanhedrin. We later see Peter. We later see Paul appearing before the Sanhedrin. So they had a lot of power. And we see zealots who we find out were zealously trying to and wanting to overthrow the Roman Empire. So they were treasonous individuals, and yet, yes, sir?
I didn't want to interrupt.
Can I hold it till about last 15 minutes? If that would wait? Okay, thank you. You see, the zealots who opposed Roman rule and would have been, you know, could have been accused of treason by their attempts to overthrow it. Galatians 4, 4 and 5, we see, but when the fullness of the time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. We see a lot of events coming together that just made it, in retrospect, the ideal time for Jesus to come into the world. We'll talk about some of those tonight. Adam Clark, a Bible scholar from the, 18th century, goes way back. He says, this is the time which God in his infinite wisdom counted best, in which all his counsels were filled up, and the time which his spirit by the prophets had specified, and the time to which he intended the Mosaic institution should extend, and beyond which they should be of no avail. Pretty good description of how Christ came in this fullness, this perfect time. Why does the intertestamental period matter? We see God's promises fulfilled from the book of Daniel particularly, but also of Malachi. See the history of the Jewish people, their attitudes and aspirations, how those attitudes and that Jewish culture were formed, which we see in the pages of the New Testament. The background of New Testament writings, Samaritans, Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians, and so on. So that was from last week. Historical context, again, this is review. We see Israel's united kingdom under Saul, David, and Solomon. They went off into idolatry and gross practices, so God ripped the kingdom away, split that into Israel, 10 tribes in the north, we're typically familiar with that, 2 tribes in the south, Judah and Benjamin. The divided kingdom was a wipeout in terms of the kings. All of them were wicked, gross idolatry, the Ahabs, a wonderful wife, Jezebel, and all of those kings of the north were awful. So God raised up a power which was Assyria. Assyria was a major kingdom in the Mesopotamian area. Mesopotamia meaning the land between two rivers. That area which is modern-day Iraq and down into Iran, mainly Iraq today, where the Tigris and Euphrates River come down, join, and empty into the Gulf. So the kingdom of Israel fell in 722 BC. So that's a date that you'll want to kind of remember. By the early 8th century, 722, Israel was taken by the Assyrian king and his people. And what the Assyrians did, we know this from extra biblical sources. The Assyrians were famous for taking their captive people and distributing them, or forced migration into other areas that they ruled. And then they would also bring people from those other areas into the captive nation. So in this case, the kingdom of Israel. So they're described as a mixed race of people. We'll see later in the New Testament where the Samaritans still believed in Abraham and the fathers and so on, but they had gone on really into false worship, had a temple in the north there that they had worshipped in, and all of that. Judah, the two tribes in the south, had some good kings, and so their destruction was delayed about 110, 120 years. But then Babylonia had been rising in its power. Babylonia had the kingdom of Babylon had overthrown the Assyrians, and then the Babylonians come in a series of about 3 different attacks, you could call them, eventually destroy Jerusalem, and take, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 45,000 to 50,000 captives into Babylon, into forced, forced captivity. Many captives taken to Babylonia. Daniel was one of those. This should be familiar to us. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that was their Babylonian names. They were taken into Babylon. And we know, again, from extra-biblical sources that the Babylonians were famous for this. They would take promising young people in their captives. Many others were killed outright or just left to their own devices, many times starvation or a minimal existence. But people like Daniel, who was promising, intelligent, and so on, they would take into Babylon and use them to develop administrative officials. I'm not going to read this all in detail, but this is Nebuchadnezzar's dream from Daniel chapter 2. Remember that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and none of his advisors could interpret it. Daniel, however, was eventually called in. He not only told Nebuchadnezzar what the dream was, but then he also interpreted it. And he said, "You, O king," there was this image, which I have a surviving photo here. This is the image with the kingdom, the head of gold, the arms and breast of silver, bronze, silver, and then a kingdom that's not named there, but we can tell from history that it was the Roman kingdom. So he said, Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, "You are the head of gold." He tells him in this dream, what the dream means is that his kingdom, starting with the head of gold, are going to be sequentially taken over. And I would say one of the objectives of the course here would be to at least know that outline of the succession of these kingdoms. The Babylonian kingdom is the reigning kingdom at that time in the Mediterranean world. It did not include all of the Mediterranean world, but a great deal of it. It's going to be taken over by the Persian kingdom, which lasts roughly 250 years, a little more, about 200 to 250 years. Very large kingdom. And that's going to be taken over by the Greeks under Alexander the Great. And then that'll be taken over by the Romans. And then it's within that fourth kingdom that Daniel shows a kingdom will arise, you know, not made by men. It will arise, in essence, out of heaven, and it will destroy those kingdoms, and it will reign forever. And I think we're talking there about the kingdom of Christ, the kingdom of God. This is just a summary there. So the head of gold represented Babylon. They deported Judah's king in 605 B.C. That last king of Judah was deported into Babylon. Then it was succeeded by the chest and arms of silver, which were the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medo-Persian Empire, the Medes and Persians were very closely related. I mean, they spoke similar languages, kind of like North and South in the U.S. They combined, in other words, they created an alliance to go after Babylonia. And with that strength of the alliance, they defeated Babylon and Babylonian Empire. But then, pretty quickly, the Persians took over the control of the Medo-Persian Empire. So it's known primarily in history as the Persian Empire. And it lived, as I say, or reigned for about 250 years until the Greeks under Alexander the Great came in and wiped them out. Greece represents the belly and thighs of bronze. Rome represented the legs of iron, and then the rock against the feet of clay, representing the kingdom of God. Final instructions from Malachi. So we're going to the last book of the Bible. Malachi prophesies that Elijah the prophet will be coming in the great and terrible day of the Lord. Notice the description, the great and terrible day of the Lord. But what it really was, it was John the Baptist coming as the forerunner of Jesus. And it was a great and terrible day for those, again, who failed to become servants of that kingdom. This slide, and I've put these slides on the church website rather than try to give them out. And I gave them some individuals that specifically had asked for them. But they're on the website. If you have any trouble downloading them or whatever, shoot me an email, and I'll send you your personal copy of the slides. Some of you, have pulled them up on your iPhone and follow along with them. So these are the four. I would say try to get this clearly in mind. The four major or kingdoms we had after the Babylonian. So the Babylonian was to be destroyed by the Persian or the Medo-Persian. The Medo-Persian lasted until 331 B.C. roughly when it was beaten, destroyed, and taken over by the Grecians under Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander was an incredible guy. We've got more to say about him, but he was very young. He was 20 years old when he took over as king. He only lived another 12 and a half years, and in that time conquered a vast land, which I'll show a slide later on. He came out of Macedonia, which is northern Greece, And just interestingly, cities like Thessalonica and Amphipolis were in Macedonia at that time. Now, unfortunately, after doing all this conquering all the way into India, he fought a battle at the Indus River, even to the east of the Indus River, fought a battle, won it. It was a hard-fought battle. His men finally says, we got to go home. I mean, we've been out here for years. So they threaten a mutiny, and he says, okay, we'll go back. So he goes back to Babylon, sets himself up in regal trappings there, and really kind of got soft. This man was a man that was born to fight, so to speak. He kind of got soft in Babylon. How he died is still disputed, but there are myths or stories that he got drunk, lay on the ground, and developed pneumonia and died from that. Others say that he may have been poisoned. But on his deathbed, they ask him who the kingdom should go to, and this is pretty well documented. He said, it'll go to the strongest. Well, that created a battle between his generals to rule. There were seven generals that were contending for the power. It took about 30 years, but it finally boiled down to four major parts of his kingdom, and we'll show that in a moment. So all of that was under the Grecian period. The two major ones that I will cover in great detail are the Ptolemaic dynasty in down in Egypt. And this is something you may, I had not really noticed. All of these emperors, and they're not emperors, the rulers, let's call them, in Egypt, there were 14 of them after Ptolemy. Ptolemy was one of Alexander's generals. I'll cover this later. A lot of names. Who fought and took over Egypt, really built up Alexandria as a center of learning and all. But he was a Greek, so he's not an Egyptian. All of those Ptolemies in Egypt were Greeks. Wild guess as to who the last of the Ptolemaic rulers was. It's a woman. Rhymes with Cleopatra. But she was a Greek. We think of her as an Egyptian, but she was the 14th ruler in this succession from Ptolemy, who was a general under Alexander that had set up this dynasty. The other one that we'll be interested in is the Seleucid dynasty up in Syria, north of Israel. Seleucus was the general that finally took over, after battles, took over that area of Syria and created what was called the Seleucid dynasty. And we'll have more to say about him later. The Hasmoneans, very interesting. This came out of the Maccabean Wars. This is a war for Jewish independence, which was won. And many people don't know this. The Israel, under the Maccabees, actually had their independence and recognized by Rome in 141, I think it was B.C., as an independent state. Now, they still paid taxes, but they ruled themselves, okay? This was after a very brutal battle that they fought not only with the Syrians, but also with many of the Jews in their own area that were favorable to the Greeks over the Jews. So that was the Maccabean period. Now, interesting enough, and I'm going to cover this later, Herod, King Herod, came out of this Hasmonean rule. We'll see how that was related, how he came to be King Herod at the time of Christ. And then the Roman period for Israel was taken over, began in 63 B.C. when the Roman general Pompey, P-O-M-P-E-Y, was given a commission to get rid of pirates in the Mediterranean. He did that in about 4 months, and he was an ambitious guy. And so there was a revolt in Palestine about that time as to who was going to be the high priest. It was between two brothers. And so he goes in there with his Roman soldiers brutally and says, we'll set up our own kingdom in here. And that's when the Jews lost their independence that they had for roughly 100 years or so. So let's go through that. This is a review. The Persian period was when the remnant of Jews returned to Jerusalem. And rough dates there, 539 B.C. to 331, when they were defeated by Alexander, right? And the Greeks. That's also when the remnant of Jews returned to Jerusalem under the Persian king of Cyrus. We'll talk about him in a moment. The second temple period began. The temple was rebuilt after these Jews came back into Jerusalem. Grecian period, Hellenization. We read that word. Hellas was the ancient Greek term for their race, their people. They called themselves the Hellas. So we call them Greeks today, but historians don't like to say Greekanization, you know, so they go back to Hellenization, but it's the Greeks. Hellenization means the spread of the Greek culture, which was accelerated, obviously, with the conquering of by Alexander of all of these periods, of all these countries. Jewish independence period from 164 to 63 BC, about 100 years. That came out of these so-called Maccabean Wars, and I'll cover that a little later, just probably next week. The Hasmoneans, who were the descendants of the Maccabeans, or came out of that Maccabean revolt, fused civil and religious rule. They did not call themselves kings, but the high priests, which were bought and sold and fought over, effectively acted as rulers. But they did not call themselves the king. They continued to call themselves the high priest. But it was not the tribe of Levi that was setting those up. The Roman period started for Israel in 63 BC and extended right up to Matthew 1. When Matthew 1 opens, that's under a Roman emperor, Octavius. Is that right? Yeah. Caesar Augustus, whose real name was Octavius. He took the name Caesar Augustus. And for there we see this Pax Romana, this Roman peace that was brutally enforced. You could do a lot, but you couldn't riot. And when riots came, the Roman cohorts would come in and they would stamp it out brutally. You either surrendered or you were going to be jailed if you were lucky and killed if you weren't. There were 14 books written between the Old Testament and the New Testament that are known as the Apocrypha. You can see all kinds of, you know, programs online and so on about the Apocrypha. New truths have been discovered. Won't get into great detail, but they are included in Catholic Bibles. Some of them were good for history, but it's uninspired history. The key thing is that none of them were ever accepted as canonical by the Jews. They knew about them, Jews knew about them, but they did not include them in their canon of scriptures, and they were not included in the Septuagint, which was later on translated from Hebrew into Greek. They were never quoted in the New Testament, like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and other books of the Old Testament. No inspired writers ever spoke of them. They just were not accepted as inspired, even in their own day, by the Jews of the time. But they do provide, particularly 1st, 2nd, 3rd Maccabees, give a lot of history of the Jewish war that we call the Maccabean Revolt. The Septuagint, just a few more minutes, is a translation of the Old Testament into Greek. How many have heard of that? Show a hand. The Septuagint, yeah. This was a translation of Greek, of the Old Testament books. And it was done in Alexandria, Egypt. That was no accident. The second Ptolemy, after the first general, was Ptolemy II, also took the name of, this is cool, Philadelphus. So it's like loving citizen or so. But he was, by all accounts, a scholar. He really wanted to elevate Egypt in the scholarly world. Alexandria, Egypt had been, in essence, founded by Alexander the Great. He founded many cities named Alexandria. But the one in Egypt became a center of learning. Their library was unmatched throughout the world of that day. They had also had a lighthouse. If you want to read something interesting, the lighthouse is called Pharos. It was out there on the harbor, and it reportedly could be seen by 50 miles. Now, we're talking being lit by bonfires, things of that nature. But it was world famous. But at any rate, by 280 BC, most of the world was speaking Greek. If not in their homes, they were speaking it in commercial settings. So in other words, if you wanted to talk to the mayor, you had to learn Greek. If you wanted to talk to the governor, you had to learn Greek. It became the lingua franca, as they call it. Today, English is spoken around the world. In airlines and airline traffic and all, it's English. And so that's really how Greek became. Well, as time went on, fewer and fewer people could speak Hebrew. And so it was this Ptolemy II that said, it wasn't just the Bible, it was books all over the known world. They wanted to, in essence, kind of capture the market of all the existing books. And part of those were the Old Testament writings. So he paid for, commissioned, and set up a group of 70, and that's why it's called the Septuagint. That's the Greek word for the 70. It's also often abbreviated LXX, which is Latin for 7. So he brings in these scholars, he puts them up in nice quarters, he pays them a fee, and they worked for years on this, translating the Hebrew Gospels into Septuagint. Now, a couple reasons why that is really important. This was done well centuries before Christ. So the prophecies of Christ are in the Septuagint. They could not have been written later, as skeptics claim, that, oh, these prophecies of Jesus being born in Bethlehem and all of these things, you know, were written later after he was born and grown up. No, they were in the Septuagint, which were put down on papyrus in Egypt centuries before Christ. Proves that many prophecies about him were written long before their full fulfillment in New Testament times. And it provided Greek translation. Remember, shortly after the conquering, certainly by 50 or 60 years after Alexander the Great, virtually everyone was learning Greek, at least for official business. Paul, of course, was fluent in Greek and could go into these Greek areas and speak well with it. It also provided the scriptures to people like Cornelius, who was what? A Roman soldier, but he would have spoken Greek, particularly being in the military. And the scriptures being in Greek provided them to people like Cornelius. He could read them, study them, zone, and become a God-fearer. All right, Paul, you had a question. I hope I hadn't made you forget it here. Right.
And the prophecy from Genesis 49 that the scepter would not depart from Judah didn't apply to King Herod.
It's a good point. I've got a slide on that, but if you didn't hear all that, King Herod was not really a Jew. He was an Idumean, which meant he was a descendant of Esau. Remember, Edom meant red. It was another name for Esau. Over time, that name morphed into Idumean. And the way Herod became king, and I'll describe this later, his father, Antipater, who was also an Idumean, got in cozy with the Roman emperor. And it was actually Pompey, who was later made emperor. He put Antipater into the procuratorship of the of Palestine. Remember, procurator really to collect taxes, but he also was a ruler. Antipater had two sons, one of them being Herod. Herod was young at the time. He was sent up to Galilee to be the procurator slash tax collector up in Galilee. And he was ruthless, fought it out with his brother, had to escape into Egypt. I'm talking about Herod now, made his way to Rome and became cozy with Mark Antony and Octavian, who were up there at the time. And they, through their sponsorship, I'll cover this later, they went to the Roman Senate, which had a lot of power, and got Herod appointed as the procurator with the title King Herod. But as Paul actually points out, he was not a descendant of David. He wasn't really even a Jew. But he did take pompously the name of King Herod and was called that in the scripture. That's a good point. Yeah, Joe. Herod the Great, yes. He was the procurator, but calling himself king. And that's so important, because remember when the wise men came, the so-called wise men, came to Herod, okay, and said they were looking for what? The one proclaimed to be king of the Jews. You could not have said anything that would have set Herod off more than that. We know from extra-biblical sources that he was absolutely ruthless and killed virtually, literally killed everybody that he thought was a threat to him, even at that time when he was old and really enfeebled. His last days, man, were awful. I mean, he got to the point he was almost a madman. I mean, they had to tie him down, hold him down, but he was still saying, we're going to kill this guy, he's a threat. And his minions, you know, his lieutenants would go out and kill him. Anything else? Joe? I haven't read anything on that. They just were not, you know, you and I have talked at length, not lately, but a year or so ago, as to how the canon of scriptures came into view. And it was because people like Isaiah and Jeremiah, were recognized as prophets in their day. They were prophesying, and what they prophesied came forth, and people said, he's inspired of God, so their writings were like immediately accepted. That did not happen with the Apocrypha and their writers. Yeah, Paul. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, good point. If you didn't hear that, the writer of Maccabees in his, and I didn't know that, the writer of Maccabees in his writings, probably the third book, says, hope this is helpful to you. If it's not, you know, I've done it, and, you know, good. And it is good history, and it jives a lot with what Josephus has written. Now, Josephus is an uninspired but Jewish man who really understands Judaism. He lived in the time of Christ, born around probably 30 AD, had been in the Jewish army, but then went over to the Roman army and was in with the Romans and wrote an extensive history called The Antiquities of the Jews. If you're ever, you know, pressed for reading material, read The Antiquities of the Jews. Take it with a grain of salt. There's hyperbole in it and exaggeration, but he's referenced as a very serious writer. He tried to get things right. He goes all the way back, you know, into Adam and Eve and Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and so on, but all the way up to the Maccabean War. Okay, we'll go on just a little bit here. The Septuagint, we've got about 5-7 minutes. Was there another question? I don't want to squelch those. Okay, Septuagint. What's happening here? There we go. Legend of a name, and this is on our slides, the name Septuagint derives from a legend that 72, some others say 70, so around 70, scholars from all 12 tribes of Israel translated the first five books, which were the Pentateuch, in 72 days. Remember where this occurred, what city? Alexandria. And they were put up, they were paid, they were provided for. However, the northern tribes were dispersed by the Assyrians in 722 B.C. True, right? And only three tribes were likely present and accounted for in the 3rd century. Most scholars believe Greek-speaking Jews in Alexandria, Egypt, performed this translation between the 3rd and 1st centuries B.C. So again, I'm not here to tell you what the absolute truth on that is. You'll see sources say that Philadelphus, Ptolemy II, imported these people, told the Jews, really, send the people you think are great scholars. Who would you think, what group of people would you think might have been picked for something like that? The scribes. The scribes, think of your life from around 18 on is copying the scripture. And if you make a mistake, you can't use that page. You have to burn it, or the scroll. You have to burn it, and then you start over. And you count the letters on each page and the words on each page. You think that over time you might learn what's in, you know, let's say Deuteronomy chapter 30. And so they got to be the recognized experts, at least in what the scriptures said. And they would have been ideal to set up, you know, with their eyeglasses and copy scriptures. But they also had to have translators. So this Hebrew word means this in Greek. This is why, again, here's things we can learn from this. Sometimes in the New Testament, you will see a quotation from the Old Testament, and you say, Well, wait a minute, that's not word for word. Well, sometimes the Hebrew word for X doesn't just totally translate over into a Greek word. So our New Testament came largely from what language? From the Greek, didn't it? And yet the Septuagint came from what? From the Hebrew translated into Greek. So that explains a lot why a verse from our New Testament may not exactly be the quotation from the Old Testament. Three centers of Jewish life. I'm getting further than I thought. Jerusalem, and I'm talking now in the certainly by the time of Jesus. Jerusalem, with the appearance of two important sects, Pharisees and Sadducees. We'll cover, hopefully next week, Lord willing, the origin of those two groups. To dig a little deeper into where they came from. Babylon became another center of learning and of culture, of architecture. The Jews had returned to a monotheism. And remember, they had gotten off into idolatry before Babylon came in and conquered them. In Babylon, they pretty much straightened up, at least in terms of worshiping the one God. You also saw the rise of rabbis and scribes. Remember, during that Babylonian captivity, the temple is gone. So all of the sacrifices are not being done. And that's why many conservative scholars say that's where the synagogues came from. It was a place to meet, read the scriptures, pray, support one another. They may not have had buildings at first. It could very well be like Ezekiel meeting down by the river. But it's thought that at least the idea of the synagogue was created there and carried on into Jesus' time. Jesus did a lot of teaching in the synagogue, so he obviously approved of it. He didn't view it as an unlawful introduction to Judaism. He and Paul and Peter all taught in synagogues. Lord?
This chart, when you refer to Jerusalem, you talk about before they were sent to Babylon. And then Babylon, while they're in captivity, then Alexandria during the silent time?
No, that's a good question. This is... By the time of Christ, you had three centers of influence: Jerusalem, Babylon, and Alexandria. Alexandria, it is estimated, had 1 million Jews by the time of Christ. If that's even close, I mean, that's a large number. And so you can see that they had influence down there. They wanted the scriptures. After what, 4 or 5 generations, virtually none of them spoke Hebrew. They were all speaking Greek. And that's why, you know, they needed that Septuagint, which was translated in the 2nd and 3rd century B.C. I'll leave you with that. If you get a chance, hopefully over the week, go back and read that second chapter of Daniel, but also the 8th chapter. The 8th chapter is Daniel's vision. The first one was who? Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. This is Daniel's vision, so the imagery is a bit different, but I want to really impact you with the next slide on it. So Daniel says, I lifted up my eyes and saw there standing beside the river was a ram with 2 horns. And he explains that's the Medo-Persian Empire, which morphs into the Persian. Now, why there was 2 horns, the horns clearly represent kings. The first 2 important Persian kings were Cyrus, who allowed the Jews to come back, but then Darius, if you're from Tennessee. So I think it's Darius the first. Both great kings. I believe that those were the two horns on the ram. The 2 horns were high, but one was higher than the other. That would be Cyrus. The 2 horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I guess that's wrong. It would be Xerxes. I saw the ram pushing westward. Remember, they're coming out of northern Iraq. They're going west. They're going south into Egypt. They conquer Egypt. Northward and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. He created a large empire. I have it on a slide later. But as I was considering, suddenly a male goat, who do you think that is? That's Alexander, came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and he moved rapidly. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had 2 horns, which I had seen him standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. We're going to see next week. This is exciting to me. I hope it is to you. But Alexander comes out. He has to carry his army across the Hellespont. It's 1 mile wide. Even today, trust me, to carry about 18,000 soldiers with all their equipment and caravans of food and so on. That's a task. They used pontoon bridges. They knew what they were doing. Comes over there and immediately is attacked by Darius II at a place called Granicus River. And Alexander's totally outnumbered, but he outmaneuvers the Persians and wins a victory right there at Granicus. Comes on down, fights another battle at Issus, which is very near Antioch of Syria, Antioch of, help me, Syria, wasn't in Syria. Another victory there at Issus, and the final victory was at a place called Gaugamela, which is in northern Iraq. So three battles, Alexander wins and defeats the greatest power on earth, the Persian Empire. But notice this. I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage, and then in red, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up. The large horn, again, is Alexander, I believe, and eventually his kingdom is divided between four generals and their successors, and tracks with the four winds of heaven. Wanted to say one more thing here, and I'll get to it next week too, but just to show you, okay, from Daniel 8, 5 through 8 and 21 through 28, and I'll leave you with this, just note the last paragraph. The ram which you saw having two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. This is Daniel's words. He told what the kingdom was, Media and Persia. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece, which history tells us is Alexander the Great. It's just, it's mind-blowing when you think of it. This prophecy would have been roughly 530 B.C. Doesn't take place for another 225 years, but actually details what the kingdoms are. And then we'll cover that later. Hey, I'm over 2 minutes. Thank you. And Lord willing, we'll keep going next week. If anybody cannot get those slides, now I'm listing them as version 1 and 2 because I'm still building. This is the first time I've ever taught this. So make sure you get the latest version if you go online. If you want me to send it to you, just shoot me an email and I'll send you the latest version. I'm sometimes editing them right up till Wednesday evening. So.